It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Breaking and entering, drunk and disorderly, law and order. A former prosecutor and a defense lawyer, not your typical pairing. And the result? Conversations about crime and punishment that are guaranteed to get you thinking.
Welcome to Justice Matters with Joe Crowley and Lizzie Green, a brand new weekly podcast. Our episodes are available on Apple Podcast, Spotify, and YouTube. Check out our Instagram for clips at Justice Matters Pod. Enjoy the episode. Listeners are advised that this episode contains descriptions of murder, violence, and other criminal acts. In August of 1980, 9-week-old Azaria Chamberlain was mauled and taken away by a dingo. Part of that was in front of her mother, Lindy Chamberlain. Over the next couple of hours, there were searches for the Azaria, which were amounted to nothing. Lindy Chamberlain then and her husband, Michael, had to accept the fact that their daughter, their baby daughter, had been killed. Not only did they then have to deal with that, but they had to deal with one of the most intense media storms around any criminal case, I think, in the history of Australian criminal law, where she was branded as a child killer, a description of how she had brutally murdered her baby in the front seat of the car by slitting its throat were published in the media, and books were written about how she killed the baby because of some kind of religious beliefs. But Lizzie, you're a former prosecutor, so I know you've got some thoughts about the media and how it reports on criminal law.
Yeah, I do. I do. I think a lot about the media portrayal of court decisions. I think of it, you know, every time I read the news on whatever media it is, because there's so much more to the sentencing process, the punishment phase for a criminal offence, than could really ever be truly understood by any ordinary member of the community. And so they're guided by the media portrayals, and I feel like this is a problem that we have.
Yeah. You've also teach criminal law. So, you know, you have the experience of having to explain to students about the sentencing process. How do you find them in terms of they're coming to you knowing presumably only what they read in the media?
Yeah, I do a little exercise anytime I'm teaching a new cohort of criminal law students, and I do a little poll and I say, who thinks the courts are too lenient on offenders? And without fail, every semester, the majority of students raise their hand. And that's the general feeling, that the courts are too lenient. But then we do an actual sentencing exercise where I give them a brief. They have to put together submissions on what they think is an appropriate sentence, having regard to all of the theories and principles that I teach them. And by the end, they all acknowledge, firstly, it is a really complex, difficult thing to do. And secondly, the courts are doing a good job for the most part with the punishments that are handed down.
Certainly, I don't think anyone can kick around in the criminal law without coming across the media. And as a defence lawyer, I've certainly seen that as well. And not just in sentencing, but in the investigation of crime. So, you know, pre-trial. And I think Lindy Chamberlain is a good example of that. But what I really want to do is look at three questions. First one, which is a pretty easy one, is why does the media report on crime? The second one, which is a bit more complicated, is what is wrong with the way that the media reports on crime? And then the third one is what is right with the way media reports on crime? Because I think the media are both an enormous force for good in terms of reporting on criminal matters, as well as a force, I won't say for evil, I think that's probably putting it too high, but certainly they don't help in terms of communication of legal principles to the public.
Yeah, I think the tendency to sensationalise certain cases is too tempting. The community gets just that grab of information without the full context or understanding.
Yeah. So why do the media report on crime? I mean, I think they do it because people buy papers for the same reason that the NT News always puts crocodiles on the front page.
Well, you're showing your age there. Buying newspapers is
possibly
a thing of the past.
That's right. That's right.
The clickbait.
Absolutely, clickbait. I mean, but so they don't report on crocheting, for example. You never see a feature article on crocheting or an editorial on that because obviously people aren't interested. I hope I'm not going to get emails from the Australian Crocheting Association now. But, you know, crime is something that people want to read. When I started to think about this topic, I thought about the Jack the Ripper case from England. So 1888, five women are brutally murdered from between August and November, and the media in Britain go mad for it, absolutely mad for it, complete media sensation. And it was through that I came across the name of this newspaper, which was called the Illustrated Police News. So that was a newspaper devoted entirely to crime reporting. So, I mean, that indicates how popular crime reporting is. People will buy it and read it. Anyway, in terms of the Jack the Ripper case, they even came up, the name Jack the Ripper is thought up by the media. I mean, they never caught the persons. They don't know. I mean, maybe his name was Jack, maybe it wasn't. But so certainly nobody knows. It was just a tagline that some journalist thought up. And it's so recognisable. So, I mean, that just gives you an example of how powerful the media can be in terms of framing a story. But, you know, that sensationalising of it, I think, was also problematic for in terms of the public hysteria that it whipped up. And so that people in London at the time felt, that they were, you know, in danger.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you talk to any criminologist and looked at the case, you would have seen that, in fact, probably most of London weren't in danger at all. Firstly, the victims were only female. Secondly, they were all prostitutes. Thirdly, they were all in the same area in Whitechapel in London. So that if you didn't fall into any of those three categories, you were probably pretty safe. But the public hysteria around it was that anybody anywhere in London or throughout the UK might be murdered by this person, you know, who they hadn't caught.
Probably safe. That's the key there. You couldn't be sure.
No, sure. Well, maybe you don't want to roll the dice. But what I am interested in is why are we interested in? Why is it that the public read stuff about criminal law as opposed to crocheting?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is the human nature is occasionally the ghoulish interest in things that people do to other people. It's why true crime fiction is so popular and true crime shows on TV. You know, everyone wants to see what the worst of the worst do to each other. And I guess you get a little snippet of that when you're reading the news reports, and even more so, it's close to home. You're reading about people in your city or your state or your country. And I guess a feeling of outrage often accompanies, you know, the reading of these articles, and you can say, oh, you know, can you believe what they did? And this is what they got as a punishment. It's so ridiculous, or it's so unfair, you know. And so it feeds the interest and the human response to bad news, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I suppose in some sense you've said a ghoulish interest. I mean, I think that's right. You people are really, you know, they want to read about these things. And if you're reading about it, it's completely safe for you, but you're reading about these horrible events so that in some senses you can let your imagination run wild and you're completely safe. I do think there is some aspect of this idea of sort of, you know, feeling better about yourself. You feel better about your life when you're reading about somebody else's life who's obviously going through a terrible, terrible time. But I think there's also an element of, you know, wanting to know information that might be relevant to, you know, your life in terms of safety and that kind of stuff. if you want to know if there's crimes that are occurring in your area and what they are.
Well, and I guess, I mean, if we take as an example juveniles, mm-hmm. juvenile offending, which is such a hot topic, you know, has been for, I'd say, 18 months.
Yeah.
I guess it's because, first, the evidence of those types of offending is everywhere because a lot of our juvenile criminals post clips of what they're doing or it gets spread on social media. It is reported, the crimes themselves, not just the punishments. And it's something that does strike fear into any person because the victims of these juvenile offenders are you, your neighbour, someone at work, you know, so it is very relevant.
Yeah, I suppose it fuels a sort of a sense of outrage. Mm. And I mean, a lot of that juvenile offending at the moment's around driving cars. So, I mean, in that sense, you know, anybody is a potential victim. What annoys me about some of the reporting on journalism is the sensational nature of it, so that they're not doing what I think journalists should do. I mean, I suppose that's probably a bit rough because there's obviously different styles of journalism. We can't expect every single journalist to be, you know, expected to write feature articles. They've got to produce a whole suite of different articles. Mm. But I still think even in the headline-grabbing articles, particularly in terms of whipping up hysteria around certain crimes, I do think they probably go too far. But I think one of the issues around it is, you know, Charlton Heston said of the movie business, the trouble with the movie business is that it's an art, and the trouble with it as an art is that it's a business. And I think the same can be said for, you know, newspapers, you know, I mean, a bit old-fashioned, you know, whatever news organisation it is, the problem with it, you know, as a sort of a way to educate the public is that it's a business. And the problem with it as a business is it's a way to educate the public. And so, I mean, I do appreciate the journalists do have to walk a fine line, but I'm not sure they get it right that often in terms of crime reporting. I mean, that coming from a lawyer and reading these things.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's why we've generated such an interest between you and I, at least amongst, you know, our colleagues. We see what's not being reported or what's being misreported or the misdirection. And that can be really frustrating because we just want the reality to be shared, not the sensationalized version.
Yeah. I suppose we have the benefit of understanding the law that's being reported, whereas journalists aren't lawyers, so that they don't. But I must say, I still think they could probably do a better job. So, I mean, you've worked as a prosecutor, so you've had some examples of what you feel aren't, you know, great. What is it that they're doing wrong in that you've seen?
What I probably take issue with is that they may very well have the kernels of truth in their articles, but the headlines, the initial paragraph are designed to engage the reader in a way that incites outrage or shock or horror.
I don't necessarily have a problem with that. It's then what then follows. If they maintain that, then I think that's problematic. Getting your attention, you know, I mean, that's part of the job, isn't it?
So let me give you an example. I found a case from March of this year, and it was a fellow who was sentenced for the offence of dangerous operation of a motor vehicle causing death. The victim was his wife of 30 years.
Yep.
And the media reported on the sentence handed down, stating in the first line of the article, a selfish drunk driver who killed his wife in a car crash just 500 metres from their Brisbane home will spend 6 months in jail. Okay, your wife of 30 years is killed because of your poor choices in your car.
Yep.
And the community reads 6 months.
Yep.
That's barely a slap on the wrist.
Yep.
But.
As a defence lawyer, the word selfish was the one that I particularly took objection to. But keep going.
But so when we look at it in a bit more detail, it turns out he'd been speeding through a 40-kilometre residential zone. He drove directly over traffic calming islands at some speed. And at the scene, he returned a blood alcohol content of more than 0.19.
Yep.
So substantially over the limit.
Yep.
The Crown prosecutor in court said he made a deliberate and selfish decision to get behind the wheel, which resulted in catastrophic consequences.
Yeah.
The report also quoted the sentencing judge, who said she accepted that the offence weighed heavily on the victim, on the accused, and that he had shown extreme remorse.
Mm.
So all of that information's provided. Great. Proceedings in court are being reported on. But the grab still is that he got 6 months. Right at the end of the article, it said that the official sentence was 5 years imprisonment to be suspended after he'd served 6 months. And so to me as a lawyer, I know that that means the court recognised for that offence the seriousness of that kind of driving, the consequences that occurred. 5 years was in fact the appropriate penalty. And for a number of factors relevant just to this offender, he was able to have that suspended after he served 6 months. But that doesn't come across. It's a little tiny line at the end of the article. And so the public are left thinking, oh, you get 6 months for killing someone drink driving.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think part of the issue is that the newspapers portray the idea that the only punishment is it's black or white. It's either jail or you're not being punished at all, yep. Which really isn't the case. And I mean, it, clearly in this case, the judge took into account the fact that this man has to live with the fact that he has killed his wife mm-hmm. effectively for the rest of his life and how traumatic that will be for him. And I mean, it's not just that he will feel, you know, horrible about that, but he has to live in the community where everybody knows that that's what he did, you know, and so that level of punishment and the remorse that he's shown, you know, is obviously something taken into account. But it is interesting that, you know, that I took issue with the word selfish being used, and I wondered where it had come from, and you pointed out that it was something the prosecutor said. Well, so that's not a finding of the court. Unless the judge says selfish, the word selfish is just a submission made by a prosecutor.
Oh, that's right.
And so that's why, you know, in some senses, that's why I object to the use of the word, because that's not the official finding, as it were. The court, if the court doesn't use the word selfish, then that's just something that the prosecutor said.
Well, yes, but that goes both ways.
Sure. Did they report anything that the defense lawyers say?
That's right. And plenty of times in closing addresses or, you know, whatever, defense counsel characterize things that are not evidence, and that's left with the jury or the court.
Well, they're not supposed to do that, but
they do.
Okay, well, I've never done that. Let me just say that. Look, it reminds me of something that I saw. So I was a judge's associate or judge's clerk. You were also. So that's, you know, like an assistant to the judge. In my year doing that, I watched a lot of criminal sentences, and we had this one sentence one day, which was just, it was so tragic. A young guy was out in town in Brisbane City for a night out. He saw another guy being attacked by a group. He went to that guy's aid, and then he himself was attacked, and he was knocked to the ground. And while on the ground, he was then kicked, and he was kicked in the head. And the arrested one guy who was found to be kicking him in the head. And that victim ended up, he was alive, so the offender didn't get charged with murder. But, I mean, he was on life. He was a vegetable, you know, he was no brain function for the rest of his life. And so the offender was charged with grievous bodily harm, the worst sort of offence you can be charged with where somebody hasn't actually died. And he had pleaded guilty, so there was no trial, so he showed some level of remorse. Anyway, and this was in court. It was obviously something the media were interested in reporting on. And I'm sure you'll remember in courts, there's an area where the journalists sit. So you know who the journalists are because they all tend to sit together. And this was a while ago. So they didn't have laptops out. This shows how long ago it is. They had their pens and paper out, and they were taking notes. They were taking notes when the prosecutor was talking. And the prosecutor was describing what had happened, and the prosecutor was, you know, giving their version to the judge. As soon as the defense counsel stood up, they all put their pencils down because I was watching them, and they did not write a single word that the defense counsel said. And then they picked their pencils up and started writing again when the judge started to deliver sentence. And I mean, that ends up with an article like the one you described, where they just give this particular view of it and they don't describe. I mean, certainly not excusing what the young man did in that occasion, but, you know, it turned out he had this horrible upbringing where he had been physically abused terribly himself, you know, and that kind of, you know, violence begets violence. He ended up becoming a violent young man and very antisocial, ended up doing this horrible thing. So his acts aren't put in context. They're not explained. We're just left with this idea that there's this sort of mindless thug walking the streets of Brisbane who attacks somebody, you know.
Yeah. As I said earlier, you know, it's a really complex thing to do impose a sentence. And so that's why the judge is assisted by submissions from both prosecution and defence. They have to get the full context of the offence itself, but also of the offender. And then built into our law is the requirement to think about broad principles, broad considerations like prospects for rehabilitation, the need for protection of the community, deterrence, you know, sending that message that this conduct won't be tolerated. And it's this really big balancing exercise. And so in your example, where they only look at what the prosecution have said, well, that's the focus on the offence.
Yeah.
And all of the factors relevant to the offender come through defence counsel. So yeah, you'd hope that if they reported on what the judge said, that those factors would be part of the sentencing remarks. But
well, yeah, I mean, as you know, I mean, judges will set out both sides, or certainly the factors of both sides that have influenced them. And so that you will, in what the judge says, get some sense of what the defence counsel says. But again, that they mightn't write that down. And certainly the reporting on that case was, you know, exactly as you've described about the driving causing death case. You know, it was very one-sided.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when the sentence is handed down, you can see why, you know, people reading it might think that the sentence was insufficient because they haven't heard half the story.
Yeah, well, and think about headlines like rapist walks free from court.
Yeah.
I know there was one from the Sunshine Coast a couple of years ago, and it was horrendous. Scariest idea ever of a guy who was lying in wait in the bushes, grabbed a jogger off the path.
Mm.
He did rape her in those bushes, but she got away and he got caught soon after. And when it came to sentence, he had gone to trial. He'd been held in pre-sentence custody for...
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Over 2 years by the time his trial came, and so when he was convicted and he was sentenced to, I think it was something like 4 years imprisonment, which personally I don't think is enough for rape, but that's within the bounds of what's accepted. But because he had spent so long in pre-sentence custody, and every day in pre-sentence custody counts as a day served off your sentence, he did in fact get released very soon after the sentencing because he'd already served all of that time. Well, none of that's explained, and the headline just says rapist walks free. Yeah. And so you can understand why the community's outraged.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but as I said, I don't have so much problem with the headline. I mean, it is sort of factually accurate, but it has to then be put in context in the article. And I think more than just, you know, somewhere before the last line of the article. Because, as, I mean, as it turns out, it served more than what a period of lengthy period of time in custody.
Yeah. I feel like with dangerous driving causing death, and I guess this is something that personally I feel very strongly about, this particular charge, and I think it's from my time as a prosecutor, I just feel the futility of these cases because the offenders in these cases aren't necessarily criminals. You know, it could be you or I who have made a stupid, wrong decision and ended up in court because those decisions have cost someone their life. We have increased the penalties for these kinds of offending. I don't know if you remember the case of Luke Harrop, who was a cyclist here on the Gold Coast, and he got killed by a woman who was under the influence of drugs. Yep. She left the scene. There was, you know, quite the hunt for her. And so when she came to court, until that point, you probably got about 2.5 to 3 years for a dangerous driving causing death as a base.
Yep.
And the prosecution in that case asked for 6.5 years.
Mm.
Defense were adamant that was too much, but the judge imposed it. And so she got the 6.5, the Court of Appeal upheld it, and that became a new standard of what the appropriate penalty is for that kind of offending. So it was a win from a prosecution perspective, from community satisfaction perspective.
See, what that example, I mean, so you, that's an example of how the law has worked to change, but how much has that been influenced by the media? I mean, are the media, are they setting the community standards, or are they reporting what are community standards?
So I know there was still a lot of outrage about the penalties she got. I mean, she was callous and showed little remorse, but she again had spent a substantial period of time in pre-sentence custody, you know. But the focus of the media was on not that this had resulted in an increase in this kind of penalty, but why so little for the loss of life of Luke Harrop. And I get that, because it's such a senseless and wasteful outcome because of a driving incident.
Yeah.
But I think the media definitely has the ability to dictate what the legislation or the parliament choose to focus on. And so they can drive change because of where they put their focus.
Yeah. I mean, we've certainly seen that in the nobody, no parole laws. I mean, it's hard to think of a change in the criminal law that hasn't come because of media interest in it. I mean, the coercive control laws that they're about to introduce in Queensland.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, can you think of a change in the criminal law that hasn't been driven by, you know, media focus?
No, I haven't got one. But I also think it's so arbitrary. Like it's down to what takes the media attention, you know, where they choose to focus it. And they do pick, you know, the juicier or the more salacious legal issues, and often they're not the only ones that need attention, you know. So
fraud cases, you think I should report more on some really dry fraud cases?
Well, those very complex arson cases with all of the specialist evidence that take weeks. No thanks.
What I've seen being a defense barrister is, you know, we've been talking about media affecting or complaining about sentencing ranges and leading to change. But what I've seen is earlier, the effect of the bad effects that media can have is influencing on police and prosecutors. I mean, I'm sure that you can think of examples where the direction that the prosecution services have taken has really been, I won't say dictated, but influenced by the way that the media is reporting on particular crimes. I mean, I've in the Graham Stafford case that I was involved in, there was hard evidence that the way that the case was investigated was in response to media reporting. I'm sure you remember, but for other people, Graham Stafford was convicted of murdering his girlfriend's younger sister. She was Leanne Holland. She was 12 years old, and she was bashed to death. He lived in the house with Leanne and his girlfriend, Melissa Holland, and their father, Terry. And it was the September school holidays back in 1991. Leanne goes out of the house to play with friends. She never returns. She's reported missing. And as soon as she's reported missing on Tuesday evening, on Wednesday morning, the police turn up at the house that Graham Stafford was living in with Leanne and start doing a murder investigation. They start swabbing the area for blood. At this stage, it's missing person. So they had decided, as effectively as soon as it was reported, that this was in fact not a missing person, this was a murder. I've had the benefit of reading the statements that they took from Graham Stafford on the Tuesday night. He goes to report Leanne missing, as does the father, Terry Holland, and the girlfriend, his girlfriend, Melissa Holland. They all three go to the police station to report Leanne missing. And all of them statements are taken. Now, at that stage, they're just witnesses. They're just providing evidence, presumably, that would help police find the missing person. But if you look at the questions that are asked by police, you know, based on what they ask Graeme Stafford, it's quite clear that they had identified him as a potential, you know, suspect. And in some senses, I think that probably a bit too early to identify him as a potential suspect, but he was always going to be a potential suspect, but I don't think they ever shifted from that. So that's a Tuesday night when he first speaks to police. They don't find Leanne's body until the Thursday. So they officially know it's a murder investigation then. And he's arrested on the Saturday. And by the time he's arrested, they hadn't even got the results of a whole lot of these scientific tests done. They hadn't even got those results back.
How does that happen?
You've got to go back a couple of years. So for anybody living in Brisbane or Queensland, you'll no doubt remember the Sharon Phillips case. So Sharon Phillips was, I think she was 21. She was she was 20 years old. 1986, she's driving along Ipswich Road, which is in Brisbane's western suburbs. And that's a poor area of Brisbane. Her car runs out of petrol close to a telephone box. She makes a call from that telephone box to her boyfriend to come and pick her up. He arrives not that long, I think 20 minutes later, she's not there. She's never seen again. Her body's never been found. What happened was that the Courier Mail then had some investigative journalists, and those investigative journalists, you know, dived into trying to find out what happened, and they were actually doing a better job than the police were, and they were reporting in the paper their findings. And in some sense, they make the police look a bit stupid. There was a book written about it by one of the journalists, and he said, it would be a masterly understatement to say that the police started off on the wrong foot when Sharon Phillips disappeared. They looked for witnesses in the wrong place for 3 days. They searched the wrong spot for physical clues to her disappearance for 4. They had her making calls from the wrong telephone box. So not only were
they... Was that all verified?
Yeah, well... I think the police eventually accepted that the things that the Courier Mail had found were correct and the things that they thought were wrong. And the fact that she goes missing, you know, is obviously something that the media report on and creates a certain level of fear. 4 years later, or 3.5 years later, another woman, Julianne Gallen, she goes missing. So this is August of 1990. Similar thing. She has a flat tire in the same area. In the suburb Riverview, which is just a little way from where Sharon Phillips disappeared. Again, alerts people. By the time they turn up, she's not there. They find her handbag and her shoes, I think, and the car. She's never seen again. Again, never been found. And so it created this feeling of fear. I actually, doing some research for this podcast, I found that there's still a $250,000 reward for information leading to conviction for Julianne Gallen, if anybody knows anything. Anyway, so that's Julianne Gallen goes missing in August 1990. So in the book written about the Stafford case, it talks about, well, I'll read it. The death of Leanne and the media publicity it generated provoked a hasty police investigation with a view to obtaining a quicker arrest. As a result, investigation procedures were narrowed, leading to the collection of and use of weak forensic and circumstantial evidence and the wrongful conviction of Graeme Stafford. And the reason the police start off on that foot is because they, you know, had been, you know, made to look silly in the Sharon Phillips case. They hadn't solved that case. They hadn't solved the Julianne Gallen case. And now a 12-year-old girl is missing. So she's reported missing on the Tuesday. She's a missing person. That's one of the reasons they instantly go into a murder investigation and that they want to, you know, get a conviction. How do I know that? Well, one of the police officers actually said as much in the committal hearing. So, I mean, as a prosecutor, you know that there's a preliminary hearing before a full jury trial, and that preliminary hearing, a committal hearing, the defence can have an opportunity to cross-examine people. In this case, they were cross-examining the police officers. And this is what one of the officers said. He was asked about why it was they had immediately sort of launched into a murder investigation and gone to the house and started taking, you know, samples looking for blood. And he said, well, what happened that day was Inspector King, as a precaution, especially that Sharon Phillips had disappeared and the police were castigated about that, about their lack of action, we brought in scientific people into the house. And not long after that, they said that there were traces of blood in the house. So he identifies that the reason that they immediately, effectively overreact, you know, is because of the pressure they felt under, because of the way, you know, the media had been reported. Now, I can't say the media shouldn't have reported on the Sharon Phillips case or the Julianne Gallen case. They should. And I can't really remember the how sensational the reporting was. But
I was 10 when Sharon Phillips went missing.
Yeah.
And lived, you know, nearby. Not, I lived in a nearby town. I remember at 10 being told about it, being scared.
Yeah.
About the fact she'd been taken. And that's at 10.
Yeah.
I think we can't say that the media doesn't ever do anything good. And I think if it spurs police on, if it uncovers facts, if it brings forward witnesses, then that is, you know, a positive, because we know that sometimes momentum comes from beyond the investigating officers. It has to be generated and made public and all of that sort of thing. But I still think that the potential for harm or misdirection is something that needs to be addressed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I agree. All right. Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for tuning into this episode. You can find links to the cases that we discussed in the description. You can also find a link to Guardian Criminal Law, and a big shout out to them for making this podcast possible.
The majority of criminal cases involve people, normal people, people like you, people like me, who find themselves in an unusual set of circumstances that would not usually occur in their life. My name's Mark Savick, and I'm here to assist you with your criminal matter. I look forward to hearing from you and being of assistance to you.
If you're interested in clips, you can look at them on Instagram and TikTok. Just search for Justice Matters Pod. See you next episode.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.